by sacrificing somebody else's rights, namely foreign nationals, immigrants, people who have no voice in the political process. We did it in 1919 after a series of terrorist bombs. We went out and rounded up thousands of foreign nationals on pretextual charges, charges of guilt by association. Not one of them was ever found to have been involved in any of the bombings. During World War II, we rounded up thousands and thousands of Japanese immigrants. This kind of anti-immigrant targeting has been a constant feature in the United States at every point that we've had a security crisis. When you want to take action before somebody has actually done anything wrong, well, the criminal law doesn't really allow you to do that generally. Criminal law requires you to have some proof that an individual has either committed a terrorist act or has conspired to commit a terrorist act or has attempted to commit a terrorist act. It requires that you put the evidence on the table, that you give a person a fair trial. But if you use immigration law, you can find all sorts of pretextual charges to use against people. The government employs secret evidence often in immigration procedures. The same sort of fair trial rights don't necessarily apply. The Supreme Court has said that it's permissible to selectively single out people for immigration enforcement based on their affiliation with political groups. So the same sets of protections and rights don't exist, makes it easier to use the immigration process.
Dan Vara was the highest ranking ICE attorney in the state of Florida from 2003 to 2006. He says that after the September 11th attacks, he began working closely with the FBI. His prosecutions became a model for using immigration courts as an arm of counterterrorism across the country.
2-3 days after 9/11, people like myself got the word from Washington that some of those obstacles that we had to doing some of the cases that we had been preparing for years were no longer there. And we were allowed to move forward and identify people for charges to be taken into detention and to be prosecuted, again, not criminally, but for the purpose of removing them from the United States. In Florida, once we began our work with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and even its precursor, just the FBI and other loosely associated groups, our involvement was day-to-day. We shared, at the height of my prosecution experience, FBI would feed me information every day.
Vara is proud of his work with the FBI and defends the tactic of seeking the deportation of residents against whom no criminal charges can be proven.
Many people get prosecuted and get acquitted, and they're guilty. When you sit at the table with other prosecutors from other branches of the U.S. government and agents from all these agencies, and you're reviewing evidence, I mean, the goal is to find the way to deal with the threat. And if the only thing you have is tax fraud, if the only thing you have is an immigration violation, then, frankly, that's what you use. An immigration charge is administrative in nature. The burden of proof is less than they are in a criminal trial. So even though you got acquitted in a criminal trial, the reality is that the government could still meet its burden if clear and convincing evidence. There are so many people that put their fingers in every single terrorism case that I would tell you unequivocally that mistakes are not made.
In terms of identifying actual terrorists, the government has been very ineffective. So for example, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the government locked up, mostly using immigration powers, over 5,000 foreign nationals, almost all Arab and Muslim, in anti-terrorism preventive detention measures. Of those 5,000, not one stands convicted today of any kind of terrorist offense. So the government's record there is 0 for 5,000.
They don't have the evidence in these cases, and that's what they see as the beauty of immigration court, is heck, you don't need evidence. You just need a judge who's willing to look at all the garbage evidence and make a conclusory statement that I think you've met the burden of proof. Thank you very much. Have a nice life. Arguably, anything is the proper use of the immigration laws. Congress has designed it to be in many ways like the tax laws that cut Al Capone. Well, if we can't get them on the criminal charges where we have to meet this incredibly high burden of proof, we'll just deport somebody on an incredibly vague immigration statute. These immigration courts are part of the Department of Justice. They are in the executive. This is not a judicial branch. This is not an independent judiciary. This judge was appointed by a previous attorney general. He works for the attorney general. These FBI agents work for, oddly enough, the same attorney general. The folks that are prosecuting this case at Homeland Security are also in the executive branch. The reality is you have the executive branch being both the prosecutor, judge, and jury in this case. We should all be concerned about that. We should be concerned that there is a complete lack of judicial independence here. Why would an immigration judge, whose boss is the one, presumably, that wants to prosecute and deport this man, say, "I'm sorry, boss, you're wrong"? Boy, it would take a judge with a great deal of courage to do that.
Many people focus on the Bush administration, and particularly on 9/11 and the reaction to 9/11, and on, for example, the Patriot Act. But what you miss when you focus in that way is that this is a broader problem.
Now we're in the middle of the Obama administration. Attorney General Holder has approved this. Trust me, if he hadn't approved it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So clearly the Obama administration is continuing the same enforcement mentality that first Clinton and then the Bush administration followed in immigration.
There's involvement at the highest levels. The Secretary of Homeland Security, I would be very surprised if that person was not, Janet Napolitano, was not involved in this case. I would be very surprised that if that was the case. Not only because it's a terrorist case, but because of the publicity that it's getting.
A local Islamic group is speaking out about immigration officials' decision to detain Yusuf Megahed.
Having a fair trial and the jury finding not guilty, it seems like a slap in the
face. Their backup plan was to punish them in immigration.
Yusuf was arrested for one reason and one reason only, and that's because he looked Muslim.
With Yusuf's trial already underway, protests by community, religious, and civil rights groups continue to grow. In an unusual move, four of the jurors from his criminal trial, including foreman Gary Meringer, begin speaking out on Yusuf's behalf.
This just doesn't seem right.
There are things under the law that were put into effect after 9/11 that allows the government to simply say, "We think you're a terrorist, and therefore you will be detained until you have your day in court," and there's no judicial review of that determination. It's just a unilateral determination made by immigration officials.
We didn't know whether Yusuf should be deported or given full citizenship and allowed to finish engineering school. What we didn't know a lot about was the case we saw in federal court, and based on that case, he was not guilty of anything, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of the evidence, as might be required in immigration court, or by any measure that we saw, this kid there was no evidence that he had done anything wrong. It's like telling the government, if that's all you got, let him go.
I've been doing criminal defense work for 15 years, and I've never heard of jurors going to the media and saying how outraged they are about what the government is doing to somebody who they just stood in judgment of. It's amazing that they would do that. But I think it says something even more about the disconnect between our government policies and what the people who live in this country want.
If I do talk to somebody about this case, what positive can come about it for me? Not forget about Yusuf for a minute. Is there anything good that can happen? And the answer is no. But this is what I need to be doing. I would really like to think at the end of the day I did everything possible I could to get him a fair shake.
I was a history major. And during the pre-American Revolution, what jurors were doing and the verdicts that they were turning down and offenses that were being prosecuted by then the British government was the same sort of thing. It was, we're not going to enforce these laws are wrong, what you're doing is wrong. And that's what these jurors are saying, what you're doing is wrong. The law may allow you to do this, but it's wrong.
What do you think is going to happen at this trial?
Well, based on the evidence that I know of, it ought to be a very short finding of not guilty, but based on what I've heard about the immigration courts, the immigration judges, the influence of the government, the fact they can put on evidence and not even have to show it to the defense, what I think is going to happen is he's going to be found guilty as some sort of terrorist aider and abettor, whatever, and sent back. Yeah, it's funny, sent back, but sent to Egypt, where he hasn't lived since he was, I think, 11 years old.
At first, I was shocked because I knew the family very well, and I knew the Mujahid family. I knew their son. I knew how good he was, and I have a son. So I was scared. I told him, you know what, I don't feel comfortable for you. What if they did the same thing to you? So it made me feel unsafe. It made me feel scared for my kids. But I felt like I can't let the fear take over me. And I start thinking, right, you know, we have rights. We're American citizens. That we should fight this. It shouldn't take this route because this is wrong. And if we don't fight now, everybody else are scared, afraid, and they're going to hide away from it. So we thought we could fight it together. And I felt, you know, we can do it. If we as a community work together, we can do it. Give me a kind of, you know, strength to stand up and fight. And the more you learn about your rights, you have to stand up for your rights. We had a privilege to fight for our rights and speak our minds and have the freedom to practice our religion, not because I'm wearing a headscarf that means I'm suspect, not because I'm a Muslim, I'm a suspect. And maybe, you know, with all of us united, you know, are united as a community, Muslims, non-Muslims, everybody else, work together to solve this problem. No profiling whatsoever. We will be all safe, because that will be justice.
Yusuf Agat, his family, his mother and his father and his oldest brother naturalized, but they're having mixed feelings because their son is still being held by immigration authorities. Please make dua for the family. Keep tab on the case and support in any way you can.
When anyone in our community or even in a minority community sees this case, especially because this family is immigrants, they see themselves and they see what could happen to them. And I think they're concerned now more than ever, especially everything that's been happening in our community with this case or nationwide. But the main point here is that we have to be aware as Americans, all Americans.
1 week into the trial, just as the defense is about to present its case, the judge makes an unexpected announcement.
The immigration judge terminated removal proceedings. He did the right thing. When the judge walked into the courtroom today, and the first thing he said was, "We're going to go over the exhibits in the case," I knew at that point we had won. Because otherwise he never would have talked about the exhibits before I had presented a case. As soon as I realized that, I turned over to Yusef, and I said, I put my hand on his leg, and I said, "You won." I don't think he understood me. He looked at me, and he didn't understand, and Dustin, my co-counsel, leaned in and said, "You won the case." And then his big old grin, "You should smile now," and a big old grin came on his face. He now understands what a great victory this is, for justice in America. The government presented a case today, and the last 4 days, it was junk. It was all about junk. And as a result, the judge finally realized what it was and dismissed it. This is the second time in my 20-year career that a judge has dismissed charges against somebody and terminated proceedings based upon the government's lack of evidence. So this is a very unique happening for me, and really for any immigration lawyer.
Outside the Chrome Jail, supporters and press wait until sundown for Yusuf's release.
I'm very happy for this. And I'm looking forward to go back to university.
I'm feeling so happy for returning my son to spend the Ramadan with us. It is the first night of Ramadan. We feel so happy by having my son to our house again. And I want to send a message for the government that this family of Mujahid, came to this country to live in peace and work and take their degrees. Let us finish this thing. Please let us, Mujahid, the family, live here in peace.
I think it's all over now. I'm happy.
Yusuf is one of the very few who beat their charges in both criminal and immigration court. Despite no charges ever being filed against him, Rabia Haddad was deported to Lebanon in 2003. After being found innocent of all charges, Sami Hammoudi was held by ICE and then finally deported to Palestine. He now teaches political science at Birzeit University. They both say that the America that they left is nothing like the country they were once proud to call home.
When people ask me about living in the U.S., this is before September 11th, as compared to Lebanon or other parts of the world, I would always make the comment that, everything else aside, it's still a country of law, where everybody is equal under the law.
I felt happy in the United States because I felt for the first time that I am free to think the way I want to think, to write the way I want to write, to go wherever I want to go. It's the opposite, 100%. I did not expect what happened after September 11.
To this day, the government can walk into anybody's home, into any company, any firm in the U.S., freeze their accounts, confiscate all their documents on the basis of doubt. All they have to do is to say, we suspect you of terrorist activity.
In the United States, there is no justice. This is what I believe in, and this is what I teach my students. I don't believe that now inside the United States, anyone can say anything he wants. No. The American Muslims and Arabs are not exercising their full rights as other Americans. They cannot, because they will be punished. And the government has many ways to punish people if they want to. And one time, Ashcroft said, if someone spit in the street, we can try him. We can make laws to try him and put him in jail, if we want.
Civil liberties, human rights, the Bill of Rights are all things of the past. This whole matter of democracy and liberty and the rule of law, and it's just a myth now. It's just a myth. Any Muslim or any Arab living in the U.S. and hearing me say this, will not think twice about it. They know it, they feel it, they're living it. But I hope that other U.S. citizens don't end up on the wrong side of the fence to find out how bad this USA Patriot Act really is.
The mentality that will harass the Muslims and Arabs, the institutions that will harass Muslims, will harass others.
Measures first introduced against immigrants inevitably get extended and applied to U.S. citizens. So over time, it's all of our rights that are at stake. So the first measures that that criminalized speech or that penalized political speech were targeted at immigrants, but ultimately became part of our criminal laws during World War I. The first measures that imposed essentially guilt by association were introduced in the immigration law in the early 1900s, but were extended to American citizens during the McCarthy era, and thousands of Americans were affected by that guilt by association. The first sort of ethnic-based targeting enforcement was against foreign nationals from countries whose ethnicity we didn't like. But during World War II, that was extended, and we ended up locking up not just Japanese immigrants, but American citizens of Japanese descent. So whether it be, you know, racial discrimination or penalizing speech or guilt by association, the measures are introduced against immigrants initially, but eventually get extended to U.S. citizens.
But it created fear amongst the Muslim community, and a lot of people have become so concerned about stepping up to the plate and being an Americans. I mean, being American means that you have to stand up for your rights, that you speak your mind, you have freedom of worship, freedom of speech. Well, none of this has really flourished in our community after 9/11. Most people are scared to come up and speak their mind simply because they've seen what happens to those who spoke.
Controlling the community is controlling their minds. Controlling their feelings. They will all the time be watchful, not to say things they like to say, they will say things that the government would like to hear, not to do anything that they show that they are full citizen who exercise their full rights.
I think a lot of people are just very scared. Like, they wouldn't really talk about things, or they would try to, like, distance themselves. So I think it's more of just trying to get by, trying to live their lives, you know, go to school, get a job, like, just live a normal life and not really so much involvement outside of that.
Back in Tampa, the Mujahid family sit down to celebrate the beginning of Ramadan, their first meal together since Yusuf's second arrest.
I didn't imagine that we are going to sit together with Yusuf in the first day of Ramadan. Welcome back, Yusuf.
I'm relieved. I'm happy that I'm out of this immigration jail. I was kind of expecting it that I be released, but not on a specific date, because the government did not have a case. Like, they were just holding me up for the heck of it. The government is profiling people. They're targeting people just based on their background, not of any crimes they have done. In my case, they, of my Muslim background, they were trying to say I'm a terrorist, or that I'm, I have to be deported on terrorism grounds. They just want you to sign the requesting deportation and leave instead of staying and fighting your case.
We asked Yusuf what he will do now that he has won. Who does he want to be held accountable for his years in prison? Will he continue to speak out on behalf of others who are facing similar charges? His father, Samir, interrupts before Yusuf can answer.
Don't ask him many questions, because the government still now can make an appeal against him.
Do you think they will appeal, or do you think...
I didn't know. They have the right to do anything.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. Whether Israel assassinates journalists such as Shirin Abu Aghaleh, imprisons and tortures leaders of the resistance, demolishes homes and destroys farmlands, raids, plunders and bombs Gaza, it cannot subdue Palestine's spirited struggle to free itself from the yoke of Zionist brutality, says Iqbal Jassad, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "Message of Palestinian Resistance is Clear. No Surrender to Apartheid Israel." Here's the story. Per pariah regimes are known to decay until they turn lifeless. South Africa, under white minority rule, is a perfect example. It has stagnated both in morality and authority, despite claiming staunch Christian values and nuclear power. The Zionist regime faces a similar ignominious end, as a replica of South African National Party's apartheid ideology coupled with racist Zionism and underpinned by settler colonialism, the fabricated regime of Israel has reached the end of an inglorious reign. Just as South Africa in its final throes committed horrendous atrocities in the foolish belief that the slaughter of anti-apartheid opponents would allow it to sustain its oppressive rule, the fabricated regime of Israel today is caught in the same rut. The regime of Israel naively believes that possessing nukes along with a powerful army replenished with sophisticated weapons and having the back of the United States regime makes it invincible. The go-to-hell approach whereby it conducts daily rituals of cold-blooded assassinations has all the hallmarks of a rotten regime. Brute military force to punish Palestinians for daring to demand fundamental human rights epitomizes medieval tyranny. As successive Israeli regime war criminals keep repeating blunders in pursuit of misplaced Jewish supremacy, they clearly are blinded by hate and prejudice against the indigenous Palestinian population of Muslims and Christians. Foolhardy and stubborn adherence to policies that are not only in conflict with universally accepted norms of human rights, but also at odds with divinely inspired religious and spiritual values is a mirror reflection of the old South Africa. Unlike rational understanding and acceptance of the inevitability of mistakes, having an ability to come back to haunt, the fabricated regime of Israel persists doggedly to discriminate, oppress, and punish Palestinians with gusto and impunity. 4 decades ago, in 1982, the fabricated regime of Israel miscalculated, as it continues to do, by thinking that driving fighters out of Beirut into exile in Tunisia would annihilate Palestinian resistance. In fact, Menachem Begin, the big terrorist responsible for genocidal acts resulting in ethnic cleansing, suggested during a speech as Prime Minister to the Knesset during the PLO's expulsion that the fabricated regime of Israel was on the verge of enjoying 40 years of peace. Begin cited the biblical passage, and the land was quiet for 40 years, saying it might well apply to Israel now that the northern border threat had been dealt with. Exactly a repeat of South Africa's false paradigm, which the Zionist regime leaders have followed since 1948, the narrative that applying military force will keep the colonial entity safe and peaceful. The blunder of the fake regime of Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon not only failed to bring peace, it resulted in 40 years of painful consequences. According to a Haaretz report, Zionist leadership failed to recognize and acknowledge that resistance to Israeli regime occupation in general and by the Palestinian movement in particular was much bigger than the PLO. To its cost, the Zionist regime's war on Lebanon saw the emergence of Hezbollah, the legendary anti-terrorist movement, a potent adversary of the colonial regime's invasion and horrendous massacres in Sabra and Shatila, among others. And all the while, in the occupied Palestinian territories, grievous atrocities committed by the Zionist regime against a defenseless population sowed the seeds of the First Intifada in 1987. And all the while, in the occupied Palestinian territories, grievous atrocities committed by the Zionist regime against a defenseless population sowed the seeds of the First Intifada in 1987 and the rise of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas. The Zionist regime's calculation of weakening the PLO by exiling Arafat backfired, as dismally as apartheid South Africa's war on the liberation movements, imprisoning leaders of freedom struggles such as Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Ahmed Kathrada, Robert Sobukwe, and cold-blooded execution of Steve Biko, Ahmed Timol, and many more personnel failed to secure apartheid's illegal reign. Whether the fabricated regime of Israel assassinates journalists such as Shirin Abu Aqile, imprisons and tortures leaders of resistance, demolishes homes and destroys farmlands, raids, plunders and bombs Gaza, it cannot subdue Palestine's spirited struggle to free itself from the yoke of Zionist brutality, as South Africa learned so will the fabricated regime of Israel, that wielding military power to eliminate as many targets at once will not attain security nor sustain any of Zionism's ill-gotten gains. Islamic Jihad's successful thwarting of the Zionist regime's unprovoked onslaught in Gaza has allowed it to emerge victorious and an important component of Palestinian resistance. Alongside Hamas and Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad has entrenched itself as a force capable to deter Israeli regime's aggression. More importantly, the message it proclaims is that the Palestinian people will neither retreat nor surrender.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The army of the Islamic Republic of Iran has staged a massive drill which features scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat drone. The drill covers the strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, as well as the country's central regions. Over 150 new advanced drones are flown in the drill. The Army's 1401 joint drone exercise involves units from the Ground Force, Navy, Air Force and Air Defense Force. The units have already carried out their intelligence gathering and patrol missions. They include homegrown Yasir, Sadegh, Yazdan and Ababil 3 tactical surveillance unmanned aerial vehicles, Pelican vertical takeoff and landing naval drone, as well as Muhajir 6 were also flown from different bases. Muhajir 6 is an ISTAR drone, which means the drone can operate intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition and reconnaissance missions. It can significantly boost Iran's capability in confronting threats. The drill features the Army's latest achievements in drone engineering and production. Due to the expansion of unmanned aerial capabilities, execution of various and numerous drone missions, and the need to coordinate such flights, the Army has set up a command and control network for the drone operations. The exercise exhibits only a small fraction of the achievements made by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Iran has, for some time now, shown that it is a world leader in drone technology, both in terms of indigenous capabilities developed by Iranian industries and the reverse engineering that Iran has done off of some of the United States frontline drones, which Iran has acquired one way or another. But it's not just the technology, it's how it's adapted for the modern battlefield.
This is the first time that a joint drone exercise is conducted at the level of the four forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army and the country's joint air defense base. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the armed sphere.
And so it's drones and the technology and the tactics are adapted to these realities. And so, it's one thing, though, to have theoretical knowledge. It's another to have practical. And these exercises, I think, take Iran's drones and allows the Iranian military to practice using these drones in realistic scenarios that will make these drones more effective if Iran is ever called upon to use them in a conflict.
Iran says it has become an exporter of military drones in the world and that the country holds the upper hand in aerospace. Back in July, when U.S. President Joe Biden was visiting the West Asia region, Iran's army unveiled its first division of ships and submarines capable of carrying armed drones.
It's the height of hypocrisy, hubris-based hypocrisy, for the United States, Israel, or any Western nation that incorporates drone technology into their operations to call out Iran for developing their own drone capability and employing these drones in support of Iranian backed actions in the region. The United States invented the armed drone, and the United States has used armed drones extensively throughout its involvement in the Middle East and Central Asia and elsewhere.
Earlier this year, Iran's new combat drone called Gaza successfully passed flight tests and became fully operational. The vehicle has a 21-meter wingspan and a 3,100-kilogram takeoff mass with the capability of carrying a payload of 500 kilograms. And before that, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveiled one of its new kamikaze drones, dubbed Mehraj 504, which is specialized in attacking enemies' defense systems. The Islamic Republic's military doctrine holds that the country's armed capability solely serves defensive purposes and poses no threat to other states.
The United States is increasing its belligerence in Syria by launching airstrikes on the country. On Tuesday, the U.S. has carried out airstrikes on a camp in Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria, claiming the area and the infrastructure there were used by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Iran rejected the allegation as baseless, saying they were a breach of Syria's sovereignty.
And you know, I'm not sure what's going on here, whether they were attacking them because they were afraid that they might be preparing to launch some kind of offensive against American troops in Iraq, or whether they were doing it just to please Israel and to make Israel say, you know, look, even if we go back to the JCPOA, we're still going to be aggressive against Iran.
The U.S. claimed that the attack was in response to a mid-August drone strike on one of its bases in Syria. On Wednesday, the U.S. then launched more strikes in Deir ez-Zor, which were retaliated by rocket attacks against U.S. bases. Several U.S. servicemen were said to be injured in those rocket attacks. The U.S. military's Central Command, which oversees the American forces in the West Asia region, said in a statement that the aerial assault had been aimed at, quote, protecting U.S. forces from attacks. Deir ez-Zor is a strategic province in East Syria. It borders Iraq and contains vast oil fields. The U.S. forces entered that region in 2015 without the consent of the Syrian government.
The United States is occupying Syrian territory illegally and criminally, and the Syrian government has the right to have what host whatever it forces it wants on its territory. And the United States forces are going to be attacked. I don't know who's going to attack them or whether they'll be attacked, but certainly the Syrian government has the right to attack them and get them out of their country. But the United States doesn't feel it needs to provide proof to people. It presumes that when it says something, people will accept it because they have to.
Washington claimed that it wanted to prevent the oil fields from falling into the hands of terrorists, but it has now turned out that the occupying U.S. forces are plundering the country's rich resources. Just recently, Syrian news agency reported that U.S. military has smuggled crude oil from Syria to bases in Iraq. It was reported that a convoy of 122 tankers laden with oil from the energy-rich Jazeera region in Syria's northeastern province of Haska moved through the illegal Mahmoudiya border crossing into neighboring Iraq.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil, and we're working with the Kurds, and we're frankly working with Turkey, and we're working with a lot of countries.
The U.S. is also running Al-Tanf military base in the Syrian province of Homs. The military base lies close to an intersection between the borders of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, and has therefore a strategic importance. It is also the only U.S. military base not located in the areas held by Kurdish militants in the Arab country. It's believed that U.S. is using the base to train and support Daesh terrorists to use them for its own benefit.
They're occupying Syrian territories, they're stealing their oil, they're occupying the most productive agricultural territory, you know, and they have absolutely no right to do this. And they're doing it, and they've said they're doing it, in order to prevent the reconstruction of Syria, in order to keep Syria down economically and socially, and it really in order to keep Syria weak and to keep alive the political project of replacing the Syrian government, replacing the Syrian regime, and breaking up the Syrian state, which they've had to put on hold, but they haven't given up.
Like waging attacks against the Syrian army or its allies. The U.S. has aligned itself with Kurdish forces in northern Syria, who took up arms against the Syrian government when the crisis started in the Arab country. But Syria's northern neighbor, Turkey, is not happy with the presence of Kurdish forces on its borders, whom Ankara views as terrorists. Turkey, which is a strong supporter of anti-Syria forces, is now considering a military action in northern Syria. That incursion would further complicate the situation in an already complex environment.
Daria Dugina, journalist and prominent media personality sanctioned by the US and the UK, was massively pro-war, that she even wrote a book about it. But was she the target, or was her father? The two had been at a cultural festival together that afternoon. Alexander Dugin had given a lecture. Similar to many of his lectures, this one was no exception and was fully in line with his views. While many believe Dugin dreamt of a new Russian Empire, others said they heard echoes of these ideas during some of Russian president's speeches, including the one about Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. Saturday's incident was first witnessed by the world through unverified video footage showing Dugin at the scene of his daughter's death. Soon after, Russian Federal Security Service said the car bombing was orchestrated and carried out by Ukrainian secret services. Kiev has, on the other hand, denied the claim, saying it had nothing to do with the incident. But whether Ukraine was behind the attack or not, Russia is bound to respond to the true perpetrators of the attack And the question remains, what kind of response can the world expect from Moscow?
Well, Russia's responses have been fairly targeted so far. They have a type of Iraq invasion in their military operations, but I believe that they will, based on their history of the last 6 months, probably respond by attacking some of the intelligence and military centers in Ukraine, perhaps in Kiev.
Saturday's bombing has left not only Russia but the world with many unanswered questions. The target is said to have been Dugin, known for his fiery rhetoric and hawkish anti-Western stance. Western media has painted him as a driving force behind key aspects of President Vladimir Putin's foreign policy. However, despite his reputation in the West, in Russia he has never enjoyed official endorsement from the Kremlin and is largely considered a marginal figure. Earlier on Saturday evening, Dugin was giving a lecture at a family festival on the outskirts of Moscow. Unconfirmed reports say Dugin initially planned to leave the festival with his daughter, who was also attending the event, but later decided to take a separate car while Daria took his car. But the question as to why he or his daughter was targeted using such drastic measures remains.
Well, Alexander Dugin is a philosopher who is also a Russian nationalist, and he has some internationalist views which coincide with many of Russia's allies these days. But his daughter also, Daria, let's not forget, was a journalist, a reporter with her own voice. She'd been in liberated Mariupol, for example. So it's not clear exactly, for example, whether Alexander was being targeted or Daria in her own right was being targeted, because apparently her car was targeted and that was not one that her father used. So it's a little difficult to say exactly what the motivation was, but they're clearly from the gloating, from the glee, from US official sources, including Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, for example, and from many of the extremist Ukrainians. It's clear that they were very happy with this young woman being murdered by a terrorist bombing in Moscow.
It is widely believed that the war in Ukraine is causing a global food crisis. But how could this be true? Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of green essentials, like wheat and corn, but most of its products can't even leave the country. This is causing serious problems in places where they depend most on this supply, like the Middle East and Africa. There's so many ripple effects from the war, but it's hard to overstate just how big the impact of the grain crisis is. Along with the shortages, you've also got the rising prices of fertilizers and fuel, as well as natural disasters due to climate change like drought, which has only further worsened the situation globally. And now UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a global food crisis as the West's anti-Russia stance is creating obstacles to the flow of Russian products and fertilizers to the world. Guterres said that the global food crisis triggered by the Ukraine conflict looms over the world. The UN chief says the West's sanctions on Russia have exacerbated the poor situation of the global economy.
Well, they are trying to use all kinds of arguments. Some are, real, based on something. Some are absolutely spurious and based on nothing, to somehow get the public opinion against Russia. And that concerns this story of grain. You know, Russia and other countries produce, much more grain than Ukraine. So the very idea that Africa will somehow starve, not because of misguided Western policies, not because of the prices which, West commands, but because five boats of grain which cannot leave Odessa, it's a joke. There were tons of possibilities for even that grain to go, and there is endless amount of possibilities to get grain from Russia, from France, and so on. So that was all mobilized by Ukraine to somehow turn the opinions that it's like all Russia fault. Children are dying in Africa, Russian fall, isn't it? And unfortunately, Antonio Guterres, rather than approaching the whole thing objectively, coming to the, to the territory, exploring it, asking questions, saying, what can we do? he more or less channels the information which is given to him by Ukraine.
But despite this, only a few nations seem to be pushing for diplomatic efforts in an attempt to restore the global supply chains, and other countries, mainly the US and its allies, continue their anti-Russia stance, pushing ahead with their foreign policy. The impact of the West's war on Russia through sanctions can be felt globally. Global supply chains have been disrupted, fears of food shortages are rising, and countries' economies have also taken a hit. But despite the heavy costs incurred by the people worldwide, the US and many European leaders seem to have set their eyes on pushing ahead with their sanctions policy instead of opting for diplomacy. Russia is a major exporter of potash, ammonia, urea, and other soil nutrients, and the supply of all these fertilizers, which are necessities for efficient production of corn, soy, rice, and wheat, has been heavily disrupted as a result of Western sanctions on Russia. A clear example of this would be Brazilian farmers, who are forced to use less fertilizers considering the shortages created in their country. In some African countries, farmers are reverting to using manure to nourish their crops. And in North America, some farmers have stockpiled fertilizers for the 2023 season in anticipation of higher prices. Meanwhile, in the United States, fertilizer bills are expected to jump 12% this year, and that's according to the American Farm Bureau Federation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA data.
No, I think the whole war is definitely, you know, war in general is should be avoided. But this one is just very cynical calculation. Somehow the leadership of NATO, leadership in Washington, decided that it's a win-win situation. A, we, you know, get opinion against Russia. B, we'll get sanctions against Russia, which will benefit us, our gas companies, our oil companies, our military companies. And see, it even has a chance to weaken Russia, which is like our enemy, to weaken Russia militarily. So they're pumping Ukraine with military forces. They're trying to push them to the battlefield. In the battlefield, Russians are killed, Ukrainians are killed in great numbers, while, you know, leadership, Ukrainian leadership buys fancy cars for themselves and they don't send their children to the front. They send some poor people to the front. So this is just exercise in the bloodshed, out of which many people hope to, you know, get some economic benefit.
But while standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. Instead of following diplomacy similar to Turkey in an attempt to solve the ongoing crisis, the West continues to follow its warmongering aspirations and further sanction Russia.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. in the limelight.
A new version of the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines published by the US government doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. We'll prepare for you an article written by Marina Bolotnikova. The piece is titled How US Government Diet Guidelines Ignore the Climate Crisis. To keep the climate habitable, most scientists agree that switching to renewable energy alone isn't enough. Americans also need to change the way they eat. Environmental and public health advocates are pushing a new strategy to help get there, including climate breakdown in the official US dietary guidelines, which shape what goes into billions of meals eaten across the country every year. Every 5 years, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services jointly publish a new version of the guidelines. They form the basis for the public-facing eating guide, My Plate, formerly My Pyramid, as well as many government-backed meal programs such as National School Lunch. Historically, these guidelines have narrowly focused on human nutrition, but some are now saying they should be expanded to incorporate climate considerations as well. The current 150-page edition for 2020 through to 2025 doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. The recently passed Inflation Reduction Act, the so-called most significant climate legislation in US history, does very little to address the food system. Jesse Silverman, a senior policy associate for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, said, "Climate change poses a multitude of threats to human health and nutrition security. We cannot extricate these things from each other." Her group and 39 others, including the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Academy of Pediatrics, in May, wrote a letter urging the US government to include sustainability in the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines, which are now in development. A sustainability component would encourage Americans to eat less meat and dairy products, which have a significant higher climate impact than nutritionally comparable plant-based foods. Another signatory to the letter, Mark Rifkin, senior food and agriculture policy specialist for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, "It will be virtually impossible to even meet the 2 degrees Celsius limit in global temperature change without incorporating substantial reductions in beef intake." Walter Willett, a professor at Harvard University's School of Public Health, said the current guidelines advise Americans to eat far more animal products than is sustainable. The primary dietary chart recommends 26 ounces of protein from meat, poultry, and eggs a week, compared with just 5 ounces from plant-based foods, although there are alternative charts that show how vegetarians can get the same nutrients without meat. He said they also still basically say 3 servings of dairy products a day, which is actually really radical because our current consumption is 1.6 servings a day, adding, "To just recommend 3 servings of dairy products and say nothing about the environmental consequences if people really did that is just completely irresponsible."